Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Well, I'd say it's been the sort of the week in Westminster.
So what has it been like in those...
In the latest episode of the national sort of calamity?
Yes.
I wouldn't say it's going very well. How would your observations be?
From the outside, I would say it doesn't appear like it's going very well, but then sometimes, you know, I think, do we have a different idea on the outside?
What do you think the public are thinking of it?
I think we're just all thinking this is insane. What's happening? And you can't say anything to reassure us.
No.
What was it like in the lobbies? Because there was the meaningful vote 2 this week. It looks like there'll be meaningful vote 3 as well. What was it like, sort of, in the lobbies on the night?
Normally, when you're winning a vote and the government's losing, there's sort of great jubilation. I wouldn't say there's much jubilation around. You know what I mean? I think it's more sort of anxiety rather than jubilation.
And what about in the chamber? Do you join in with the jeering?
Yeah, no, I don't join in the jeering, really.
Do you ever jeer? Have you jeered?
Only on this podcast. No.
Do you never do?
Sometimes a bit of sort of harumphing, I think. Quiet like, harumphing.
What, like that? Whoa.
Oh, come off it, I'll say. Oh, for goodness sake.
Oh, I'd love to see a bit of that.
Well, the thing is, everybody got very outraged after what she said after No Deal, and she kept shaking her head. So I actually got up and did a point of order and said, look, instead of the Prime Minister shaking her head, wasn't she come and explain why she disagrees with it? But she, to be fair, she had sort of, you know, nearly lost her voice.
Part of the way she's been with this deal reminded me of a little bit of you with your make your own sandwich shop idea, because people keep saying, Ed, it's not a good idea. This isn't going to work. But
you think I should have meaningful vote 3 or make your own sandwich?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Do you think maybe I should say that to her? I say, look, it's like the make your own sandwich thing, this meaningful vote thing.
But that would involve having to have the humility to accept that your make your own sandwich chain is a bad idea.
But also then I'd have to like explain the make your own sandwich thing. I'm not sure it's... I mean, you know, there's obviously a fine judgment about what appropriate point of order is in the House of Commons. But I think getting up and saying, Mr. Speaker, this is like my make-your-own-sandwich-shop idea on my award-winning podcast, you know, where I kept going with my make-your-own-sandwich idea. And, you know, I don't think it's orderly to carry on with this idea when people are clearly dismissing the idea and there's the issue of the goop and hygiene and so on. And really, the Prime Minister's meaningful vote number 12 is like, I think I'd have lost people.
Right.
I'm not sure it would be classified as a point of order either.
Did you at least feel a bit sorry for her losing a voice like that?
I did. I actually sent somebody who I know in Downing Street some advice. Do you remember I lost my voice? before Prime Minister's Questions once, and then I sort of got it back for somebody to Mercy Dash for kind of weird steroid things.
You call the witch doctor.
Yeah, and all kinds of other things. I don't know. I mailed it in. So, on the podcast this week, we're talking about what is, I think, one of the most scandalous things in our country, which is that poverty is affecting more and more working people. You've got 8.3 million adults and children in working households in poverty. Working poverty among adults is the highest in 20 years. Now, there are solutions to it, and we're going to be talking both to people here about the concept of the living wage and other things that can be done, and also about a very successful campaign in America called the Fight for 15, which is a fight for a $15 minimum wage. And it's actually a very inspiring conversation about the campaigns that people are running, and also how our listeners can get involved in living wage campaigns in their area or in their workplace.
And we're joined by comedian Pierre Novelli, who will be pitching us his ideas, which could be, if they were implemented, reasons to be cheerful.
What's yours?
What's my reason to be cheerful this week? I went to a supper club. So I said this to somebody a couple of days ago, and they said, that doesn't sound like you. I said, but I love supper. And they thought I'd gone to some kind of salon for like-minded individuals where you all sit around and have, you know, high-minded conversation. But it wasn't one of those. It was just where somebody, I got the impression, who would like to open a restaurant, but they need to do some dry runs and get a bit of a head of steam going. So I went to one of those and it was great.
Why is it called a supper club though?
Because they haven't got an actual restaurant yet. So they do a takeover of like a little cafe and they descend on it and use their kitchen. And then everybody all has to sit down at the same time.
Did you have to do anything?
I just had to eat. I was worried that I'd have to talk to the fellow diners, but all I had to say to one of them was, oh, can you pass me the bottle of water, please? And that was it.
And what did you have?
It was food of the Silk Road. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that I today met Morten Harkett and Mags from Aha.
Uh-huh. How was that? Because, you know, we all know that your all-time favourite song of all time is Take On Me.
And I did the whole business.
So why were you meeting them? What was the context?
Take On Me is approaching its 1 billionth view on YouTube, which is almost as many as our things on YouTube. The record company's making a little film and they knew I was a fan. So I met them and it was good. Norway Plus.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So we're delighted to be joined now from Chicago by Tyree Johnson, who is a Fight for 15 campaigner and a McDonald's worker. Tyree, hello.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little about how you came to be involved with Fight for 15 and what your history with McDonald's is?
I've been in McDonald's work for 27 years. And in August of 2012, a young lady came and got me at my McDonald's store and took me for a cup of coffee and sat me down and explained to me what Fight for 15 was all about and why it's important to join and get started. So once she explained to me what it was all about and I understood everything, I simply signed the card and became a member of the Fight for 15 in August of 2012.
And what was it about what she told you that clicked with you?
She said, you can be a leader in your store. All you have to do is communicate with your coworkers. And the way I'm describing to you how important it is to be a 5-15 leader, you can also educate your coworkers as well. She taught me how to get on Facebook and set up all my email. And I got introduced to 5-15 members. I've been dedicated to McDonald's. But the poverty wages is just not helping me survive. So I stayed dedicated to 5-15 and kept my McDonald's job. Just stay dedicated.
And you've had some success because in February of this year, Illinois became the fifth state in the United States to pass a $15 minimum wage law. Can you talk to us a little bit about the difference that will make to you?
It will mean a whole lot for me. I can pay bills on time. I can stop living in poverty. I can put some money up for a savings account. I can take care of my health benefits. You know, it's a shame when your family member come to you and ask you for money and you can't provide for them. But now I can. And yes, I would have had the pleasure of going to Springfield and watching our governor sign the bill.
You were there at the governor's mansion at the signing?
Yes. It was an SB1 bill. and they got approved 69-47, and we won.
And when you started your fight, Tyree, what were McDonald's saying to you?
Oh, you're wasting your time. That's $15 is never going to happen. You're wasting your time with this movement stuff. Just focus on your McDonald's job and do what you have to do here. But I told them, no, you're wrong. I'm going to keep fighting, and when you fight, you win. Giving up and quitting will never happen with me. I'm going to stick with this fight and keep and don't let McDonald's try to talk me out of nothing.
And now you've ended up in the governor's mansion with the $15 minimum wage achieved. What do they say to you now?
I get respected on the job. And my coworkers congratulated me. Thank you for fighting for me. We got $15. Thank you. When they read the newspaper, and I went back to my job and I said, we won. We won. And they was like, oh, thank you. God bless you. I love you for that. You fought for us. It motivated me to stay involved with my fight and continue to fight McDonald's because their policies, I don't agree with their policies. So I'm going to keep fighting and stay involved. Fight for 15. It's power in numbers. And if we stay together and keep acting like the union, we can win.
Tyree, you've obviously got the magic touch. And now that you've won the fight for 15 in Illinois, where'd you take it next?
We're fighting for the union now. You can't have one without the other. You have to keep fighting. The fight is not over. We won 15, but we need a union. Because with the union, they would have to treat us with respect and give us what we deserve and not play around with our hours. We need our health benefits. We need child care. We need everything. We need an end to sexual harassment and discrimination in the workplace. All those factors come into play once we get this union.
Tyree Johnson, you're such an inspiring example to us all. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, and you have a blessed day.
So let's now turn to, if you like, the British version of the Fight for 15, which has been the fight for a living wage. And I'm delighted that we've got Lola McAvoy from the Living Wage Foundation, campaigns director, who's joining us.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming in. Tell us, first of all, about the Living Wage Foundation and how it came about.
The Living Wage campaign started in 2001 by community organisers from Citizens UK, which is the home of community organising in the UK. And they went into East London and started meeting with people from different institutions, like mosques, churches, schools, and asking them what was going on in their lives and what issues were affecting them. And over and over and over again, kept coming out that low pay was a huge issue and people were working sort of two or three jobs, not being able to make ends meet on the minimum wage. So that's how the idea came about that they should start thinking about campaigning for a living wage. And when they were talking to these leaders and these people from the community, they found one guy called Abdul, and it turns out that he was an outsourced cleaner working at HSBC, and he was cleaning the CEO's office every night, and he'd never met him. And so obviously, from a campaigning point of view,
golden opportunity.
Absolute campaign gold. And he was a great guy. He was incredibly brave. And he said, okay, let's do this. Let's, you know, find a way to lean into this big, powerful organisation and try and make a difference and win a living wage. And what happened was that they found different people who wanted to donate to the campaign and bought shares in HSBC, and then went and spoke at the AGM and said to the chief exec, you know, I'm Abdul and I clean your office, and yet I can't see my children because I'm working two or three jobs and what you're paying me isn't a real living wage. And that's really what put a rocket underneath the campaign. After that, it went from strength to strength. And then in 2011, the foundation was set up as the business-facing arm. So really we're the organisation at the heart of the movement. And we provide the nuts and bolts of accreditation to the 5,000 businesses who go further than the government minimum.
It started in 2001, and now there are 5,000 businesses signed up and accredited. What does that mean, accredited?
So living wage accreditation is quite radical. Two words you don't often hear in a sentence.
Yeah.
Because what it means is that they pay all of the directly employed staff a real living wage. That's £9 an hour in the UK, with a higher London living wage of £10.55 an hour. But they also include their third-party outsourced staff. So the cleaners, caterers, security guards are included in that accreditation. And that is really what makes the difference, those low-paid workers.
Then just to sort of avoid confusion, explain to us the difference between your real living wage and what's called the national living wage, which was introduced by George Osborne when he was Chancellor.
And then while you're at it, can you clear up for me why the minimum wage shouldn't just be the living wage?
So the national living wage, which is the government minimum for over 25s, is pegged to 60% of median earnings. And the Chancellor announced recently that they're going to look to extend it to 66% of median earnings. But it has no bearing on living costs. It has nothing to do with the cost of living. So our rate is independently calculated each year by the Resolution Foundation. And it takes into account things like travel costs, inflation, housing, bills. But it also takes into account a social consensus for what people who are working should be able to afford. So one year a smartphone might have gone in, or another year they might take into account people needing a car when public transport might not be sufficient anymore. So the reason why the Living Wage Foundation doesn't call on government to make the real living wage the government minimum is because our campaign has always been about not waiting for politicians to make decisions. Ours has always been about getting businesses to act now. Why wait for the next general election, the general election after that, and then a couple of years in for them to uplift the minimum wage? What we want to see is businesses who can afford it, and there are plenty, signing up to pay the real living wage now.
Talk us through the reasons you give to businesses for paying the living wage, why it's, you know, good for their businesses and their employees, and then what the reaction tends to be.
Well, first of all, I would say that the majority of our businesses who sign up do tell us that it's a values-led decision, that they weren't, again, it comes down to this interesting point about outsourcing. A lot of our businesses didn't realise that there was low pay in their cleaners. They didn't really know what their cleaners were paid because they're outsourced, or they didn't know that the security guards weren't earning enough to live on. So that's the first thing, is that when we explain to them that you have actually got real issues with low pay in your organisation, that's when they start thinking about accreditation. But also there are huge business benefits. So the more low paid people you give a pay rise to, the more business benefits you'll see. Obviously, that's not rocket science. But they see a higher motivated workforce, obviously higher retention rates because people don't leave the job so quickly, which then saves on HR costs for recruitment. So there are big and brand benefits. You know, ultimately, when you hear that your football team pays the real living wage, you're over the moon.
If they're accredited by you, they can't be sort of one step removed from subcontractors like cleaners and so on. Everybody they subcontract as an employee also has to receive the living wage.
Yeah, that's right. So the way it works is that if you have a member of staff who works for 2 hours or more a week for 8 consecutive weeks on your premises, they fall within scope of living wage accreditation. So that is ultimately cleaners, caterers, security guards, and all those people that you might see wearing a different uniform, but ultimately are in the same workplace every day.
How much of a problem is outsourcing?
It's an interesting point because we've got this scheme called the Recognised Service Provider Scheme. Again, quite dry, but pretty rad. And they
like
are...
you, yeah. Thank you. Quite dry, but pretty rad.
Maybe that should be my slogan. Dry, but rad.
Yes.
So the Recognised Service Provider...
You've invented a new slogan for us, Lolo, for me.
It's great. Yeah. So the recognised service providers are facilities management firms. So they're the ones that, they're your Carillions, your Interserves, your Sodexos, and service that's the facilities management sector. And we've got service providers who sign up to our scheme as recognised service providers, and they offer two bids. So when they are talking to an organisation, they'll say, look, because of the market rate, which is often the government minimum for this contract, we want you to think about paying the living wage. So we'll cost up what it would cost you to ensure that all your cleaners are paid the living wage. And then we'll also offer you a market rate bid as well. And it's up to you as the client to make the decision. Now, what we've seen from that scheme is that loads of the clients are signing up to the real living wage to choose the real living wage bid.
What sort of percentage?
So we've seen, depending on the service providers, one of our service providers, I think, is... made sure that out of all of his contracts, 70% of them are now real living wage, which is pretty rad. One of the things that I would say about the outsourcing sector and the impact it has on the living wage is when you dig deep into the data. So outsourced workers aren't included in gender pay gap reporting. Right. They're not included in freedom of information requests. They're not included in parliamentary questions. So they're completely invisible.
That's really important.
It is interesting because they're completely invisible from any public data. So if you as a campaigner, Jeff, decided that you wanted to find out if your council were paying the real living wage and you thought, oh, I'll pop an FOI in and find out, they might come back and say, oh, actually, only 10 people are paid below the living wage, but they're masking all of their caterers, cleaners, security guards, refuse collectors.
And that's not even getting into suppliers. That's a whole That's suppliers is a whole different thing,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
The people you buy from and all that.
Exactly.
And is that part of what you do?
So the people who fall into scope, no, so we don't do supply chain, because the people who fall into scope, it's just people who are working basically on your premises or in a franchise.
Now, one of the most important things about your campaign is it hasn't sort of happened just because nice businesses wanted to make it happen. It's because of pressure, hasn't it?
I mean,
it's
your campaigners. I think that's fair to say, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's your campaigners, Citizens UK.
A lot of the trade unions.
A lot of the trade unions, that's the thing. So for our listeners, how can they get involved in some of your campaigns? I mean, you've got this campaign at Picture House, which is ongoing. Tell us about some of your campaigns you've got going on at the moment and how our listeners can sort of, you know, help make it happen.
I think the best way would be, as an employee, go and ask your HR manager, are you accredited with the Living Wage Foundation? Because your HR manager will say, oh, of course we pay the living wage. You get above it, don't you? And then you need to say to them, as a employee of any type of, because we accredit all types of employers, you need to say to those HR managers, are you accredited?
Is the House of Commons accredited?
So the House of Commons is accredited, but the Cabinet Office isn't. So you've got a lot of government departments. You've got low pay in the government departments.
No, I knew
the
that.
The cleaners of Whitehall, but you haven't. But the House of Commons and the House of Lords are accredited.
Right. Sorry. Anyway.
Sorry. So if your listeners wanted to get involved, what I would suggest the first thing they do is go and talk to HR, find out, are we paying the living wage to our cleaners? And if we are, can we accredit with the Living Wage Foundation? Just see what they say. Because a lot of them...
And if we're not, walk out.
And if we're not,
withdraw your labour.
Well, a lot of the successes of the campaign have been from people taking a stand and becoming living wage champions.
Give
internally.
Us some heartwarming examples.
Okay, I'll give you my favourite example is big shout out to Stuart.
Rad but dry example.
Stuart Wright at Aviva. So he's director of facilities at Aviva. So again, you know, not somebody you'd naturally think would be a campaigner.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about Stuart is that so we said the power of the Living Wage campaign is always in testimony. And that's a bit of a jargony word, but it means lived experience. So a story from somebody who's directly impacted by this campaign, instead of a load of lovely middle-class people deciding what they want to do in an attic at Islington, it might be that they...
For example.
E.g., it's more about making sure that when we're speaking to people, we're finding these lived experiences and these testimonies. And Stuart, we said that to Stuart, we laid the challenge down and said to him, look, Stuart, you need to find us somebody who's been impacted in Aviva. And he went, all right, leave it with me. And he went through the whole of Aviva and he went through all of his comms people and he went through, you know, this is a massive FTSE 100. And he found Lynn, and Lynn's story is fantastic, so I hope I can do her justice. But basically, she's a grandma and she's a cleaner at Aviva in Norwich, and she's like been there for a few years and loves her job. And she, a couple of years ago, before they were accredited, she became she got custody of her grandchild, her granddaughter. And so she realised that actually money was going to be tight. She's going to be looking after her granddaughter. And then she says, you know, just in the nick of time, Aviva accredited and she got that little pay bump. And what she did with that money was put it away. She didn't spend it on herself. She didn't spend it on all the things that you might, you know, think somebody might spend it on. She saved it up so that her granddaughter could have a laptop so she could do her homework from home instead of in the school library when she was prepping for her GCSEs. And, you know, big up to Lynn, because she's told that story on the media. She's told that story in Parliament. But also big up to Stuart, because he decided that actually this was a campaign above and beyond his normal role. And that's what the listeners can really do.
That's
if they want to get involved in the campaign, that's how
so
I would
go on your website and all of that, Malachi.
Yeah, go on the website, sign up. If you are an employer, obviously sign up.
And I know you've said that it's not about waiting for government to catch up. But we have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, where I suddenly find myself as benign ruler. But all I'm interested in really is...
Let's be honest, crazier things are happening in the country than this.
True.
I mean, you know.
And all I'm really interested in is having my face on stamp. So I do a lot of delegation. Mm. If we were to appoint you as Minister for Work, perhaps, what is the first thing you would do in that position? In other words, what could government do better?
Okay, so... as I said, you know, the campaign has been a success without calling on government to do anything. But if you put me in a bind and said I had to come up with something, I would first of all accredit the Cabinet Office to make sure that all those cleaners in Whitehall were paid the real living wage. And then, and again, this is a bit technical, I would think about stipulating that living wage was a really good way of demonstrating social value in the national procurement framework. So that there's £250 billion of public money going on services and goods and services through government procurement. I would put living wage in there so that to win a contract with government or with the public sector or any public money, you had to pay everybody the real living wage.
Great idea. And do we have any data on how much of that £250 billion is being spent on companies that aren't living wage?
We could probably find out how many of them are being spent with contractors that aren't living wage. But obviously, as I explained, service providers don't tend to accredit. They tend to go on
what you need is a willing MP who'd be willing to ask parliamentary questions and find out about it.
They're missing. They're missing from the data. So if you did ask parliamentary questions about those contracts, you wouldn't know how many people were being paid less than the living wage. And I think that's what's quite interesting about it.
You were very eager to ask a question on that, weren't you?
Well, I think...
Before, when we mentioned the Cabinet Office, you were keen to go to the HR department, start asking them questions.
I mean, obviously. That would be great.
I'm young and enthusiastic.
It is more about thinking about how we can make sure that these invisible workers are more visible in data, really. And that would be the ask for government, because ultimately, at the moment, we have no idea what the extent of low pay is in our public sector.
Lola McAvoy, you've been brilliant. You've coined a new slogan for us. Dry but rad. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Joining us now, Ed lights up like a firefly whenever he's around. It's Torsten Bell, director of the Resolution Foundation. Hello, Torsten.
Hello. It's always nice that some people are easily pleased.
You're our explainer-in-chief, Torsten.
And also co-parkrunner, the two of you.
He's slightly faster than me.
Slightly means a lot. What are you coming in at these days?
27-something.
Okay, 7 minutes, yeah. But the good news is there's room for
improvement.
You are
significantly younger than me.
I am a little bit younger.
Yeah. What have you noticed about Ed's running technique?
Well, I'd say this. If you were doing a kind of, analysis of it, you would say there were challenges on the speed and on the style. But there's still time for both of those things to
improve. I would have thought the Swedish judge was giving me good marks on artistic impression there.
It depends how much kind of flapping you want in your running movement.
So rude. Right.
Back to Britain.
Okay, so you're our explainer-in-chief, as I say. Let's just start. We've heard about the Fight for 15, and we've heard from the Living Wage Foundation, who I know you work with. Have these campaigns made a difference on the sort of stats and the impact on people's lives, in your view?
These campaigns, first of all, are a really good thing. They're a good thing because, one, they actually get people's living standards up, and two, they're engaging civil society in issues that too often are left just for politicians
like you.
Yeah, to debate. And that's a good thing. And they create energy and they show people, if we step back and look at Britain over the 25 years, one of the sad things is that nobody talked about or thought low pay was an issue, even though a fifth of the population were low paid.
We did when I was leader.
The odd person now and again chatted about it. But anyway, so that's a really good thing. And that's building popular pressure for it. In terms of actual numbers of people, of course, the living wage and the individual cities in the US aren't as important as the legal minimum wages, which affect a much larger number of people. But that doesn't mean they're not important, both for setting pressure and for the individuals concerned, when they make a lot of difference.
And just to be clear about what's happening here, and this is a sort of, I think it's a paradox or an apparent paradox, I think you're going to have to explain, which is that low pay is going down, partly as a result of these campaigns, partly because of the what's called the national living wage, although as we've heard, it's not the sort of real living wage as proposed by the Living Wage Foundation. The number of people on low pay is going down, but poverty for people in work is actually at its highest level for 20 years.
So that is an important paradox to understand about what the nature of kind of what modern Britain and kind of living standards in the country is, which is we are seeing the first big falls in low pay since the 1990s at the moment.
When Labour introduced the minimum wage.
So Labour introduced the minimum wage at the end of the 1990s, but because the minimum wage was coming in at a relatively low rate at that point, it didn't get the low pay rate down. And the slow and steady increase of that rate through the 2000s and now big rises of the minimum wage through the national living wage, that is causing the first big falls in low pay. That
as measured by what?
As measured by somebody who is working but is below 60% of the median wage, the typical earner. So they're earning, just below two-thirds of a normal salary. Now, because the national living wage is increasing, it's £783 right now, and in a few weeks it will go up to £821. Those are relatively large rises, and they're faster rises in the minimum wage than you're seeing for people in the middle of the earning distribution who are only seeing wage rise of 3% or so, which is another big problem we're facing. So that's the good news. The good news is low pay is falling. More people at the bottom are getting pay rises that are taking them out of low pay. Now, the bad news is that that is not all that matters for family and household incomes. And it's incomes and the whole household and the costs as well as the money coming in that matters for people's poverty. And unfortunately, child poverty has been rising reasonably slowly, but rising over the last few years. And we forecast it to rise possibly to record levels in the next few years. And that is one of the big problems facing the country. And that's what people should be talking about.
And child poverty for families who are working, that's a very high level. I think I'm right in saying that, according to the Roundtree Foundation, 8.8 million working age adults and children are in work and in poverty. And that's something like 18% of the population.
Yeah. So most poverty in Britain today is in working households. So the myth that people have got in their heads that poverty looks either like a really poor pensioner back in the 1990s, or it looks like, you know, feckless parents who don't work and who are therefore keeping their kids in poverty, which is what you too often heard. Maybe less, actually. I think you less hear it today, but 5 years ago, you would have heard it. Those things are not the problem today. The problem today is parents with children who are in work, but are not bringing home enough and getting enough support from the state to take them over the poverty line. That is what poverty looks like in 21st century Britain.
So is the cost of living getting more expensive, or is it to do with government austerity?
So there's a bit of both of that. Over the long term, rising housing costs have been a big part of what makes it hard to be to live on low incomes in Britain. In particular, as we've then made housing benefit the money we pay from the state to help people pay their rent, that's become less generous, particularly recently. That is having a big effect. But the thing that's driving up child poverty right now and in the next few years is active government decisions to reduce the support via the welfare state for lower income families. It's not universal credit that is doing the increase in child poverty. It's just happening at the same time. What's causing the increase in child poverty is the freeze of all working age benefits. They've been frozen for 4 years. The last freeze is coming into place in just 3 weeks' time. That has taken £4.5 billion off lower income families. That is a big cause of the child poverty rise we're seeing. And the government has also restricted the support that goes to larger families, those with more than two children. And in general, the system has just become less generous. Families are getting less money through either tax credits or universal credit. So yes, it's happening at the same time as universal credit, but child poverty increases is not just about universal credit.
So what are we going to do about it? You know about this Jeffocracy, benign ruler.
Very dangerous.
Very benign.
That's what they all say.
if he sort of made you the Secretary of State for work, pensions, and general control freakery. What would you be? Give us the kind of toolbox, and then what you do?
Well, the first thing to say is we need to keep on being ambitious about the minimum wage. We still want to see people on lower earnings getting higher pay, so long as that doesn't have a big effect on the employment rate. And so far, with the big increases we've had here, those haven't led to problems on employment. In fact, we have record employment in the UK today.
And that's quite significant, isn't it? Because the old thinking was, if you increase the minimum wage, it causes a fall in employment and so on. That was the argument people made.
Absolutely. And there's been a transformation in both policymaking circles, but also amongst economists, about being much less anxious about whether pushing a bit more on the minimum wage will cause bigger unemployment.
And is it because these big companies can afford it, or what's the reason?
Yeah, so it is to do with who has power in the labour market. And one thing you would conclude from the big rise in the minimum wage not having an effect on employment rates is that low-paid workers did not have enough power, and that the point of minimum wages is to give them back that power. So that's a really good thing. We should keep going on that. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be, we don't know what too high looks like on the minimum wage. There will be a level that is too high. So we shouldn't just be kind of completely gung-ho about it, but we should be ambitious, push it up while keeping on looking at the evidence to make sure there's not an employment effect. So you should keep doing that. Then secondly, we need to recognise that the family income is not just about hourly earnings, how much you get paid per hour. It matters a lot how many hours you do in the week. And in particular, that is true for lower paid workers who are much more likely to be part-time. And if you look at the big trends in Britain over the last 20 years, you can see a trend for lower paid men in particular towards part-time work. And that is one of the contributing factors.
Not chosen part-time work, but sort of involuntary. Is that right?
So if you look for some, for lower paid men in particular, yes, their part-time and low hours is likely to be involuntary or more likely to be involuntary than other groups. Higher paid workers tend to say they actually want to reduce their hours worked. So yeah, that's the big picture. So we should keep focusing on that. We should be in favour of giving people more power and control over the hours they work. And then we also need to help people progress off the minimum wage onto higher wages. And in too many sectors at the moment, the chances of progressing are very low. So if you look at retail, for example, sales assistants in retail sector, only 4% of them progress off that job into being sales supervisors, even over 5 years. In fact, if they want to get promoted, they basically have to leave the sector at the moment. And that is a very bad thing, not least because if you're working in a retail job that isn't near and lots of other jobs, you haven't got those options. So we need to be focusing on progression within work, not just pay at the very bottom. But we also need to recognise the state's got to cough up. Like, if you want child poverty to come down, children are expensive. And the labour market is not going to cover all the extra costs. We're not going to start having a different minimum wage rate for people with kids and those without. And that is what the social security system exists for. That is why we pay child benefit and have been doing for decades. That is what universal credit is there for. And if you don't make that system generous enough, you will see rises in child poverty. And there's no way around that.
And housing costs are just very expensive. And therefore, this is a big part of the problem.
Yeah, so this is housing costs, so you know, in podcast land and journalism land, housing means home ownership and that, and obviously the things that are driving down home ownership are high housing prices. That is driven by a lot of things, including low interest rates. So I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about housing costs, so rents in particular. Yeah. And if I look at the child poverty figures, it's pretty likely that within the next 5 years, more than half of children growing up in either the social or the private rented sector will be in poverty.
I suppose one of the things that this conversation gets across is that you need a whole range of tools to deal with this. And, you know, some of them are sort of blunt instruments. Doesn't mean they're not important. One thing we've not mentioned is the role of trade unions in bidding up wages. That's part of it, surely.
So if you want to see poverty coming down, then yes, it would help to have a broader push up on wages, particularly amongst lower but not the very minimum paid workers. And one of the ways that you can do that is to make sure workers have more power, and in particular lower paid workers have more power. And that is where trade unions can come in. And, you know, the historical evidence shows, and actually cross-country evidence shows, that in sectors with a strong union presence, you can get better pay outcomes for the bottom half of the earning distribution. So that is part of the answer in some sectors, yeah.
So Torsten, just finally, I was feeling quite optimistic earlier.
Until we met you
about the campaigning around living wages. What have you got for us to be optimistic about?
Well, let's start with what's to be pessimistic about. What is to be pessimistic about is that we're on
the... that.
No, we're coming back. I'm going to end on optimism. You don't want to get your ordering wrong here. Come on. Right. So what is there to be pessimistic about? If we don't do something, child poverty rates are going to rise in the next few years. And that is something that should make everybody angry and make all politicians want to change that direction. What is there to be optimistic about is that sometimes these worrying trends look like there's nothing you can do. But both what's going on today and history teaches us that policy can do something about these things. So let's take that. History teaches us that in the 1990s, people thought having 20% of the population in low pay was just something that we were going to be stuck with forever, and we couldn't do anything about it because minimum wages were mad and they'd lead to loads of job losses. Policymakers pushed ahead with the minimum wage, and then with the ramping up of the minimum wage into the national living wage more recently, and that is bringing down low pay. So reason for optimism one. Reason for optimism two is that just like we can bring down low pay, we can bring down child poverty. And child poverty in the 2000s fell hugely, nearly halving over that period. Why? Because politicians, policymakers, public campaigners and others said it is not okay through no fault of your own to be brought up in poverty, and the state's job is to support parents in bringing up kids. That doesn't happen. And that can be done. It does require difficult choices, but those can be made. So from both low pay and child poverty, we know policy can make a difference. So it's time to get on with it.
Torsten Gins, thanks so much. So what do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of exciting things. Yeah. I think, firstly, I can sometimes be sceptical about companies and corporations and just feel like whatever they can do to add to the profit margins. Yeah. And it's exciting that this living wage campaign and things like it, they're going to these corporations and showing benefits of paying people more. But also this idea of what it says about you as a company and companies having values and tapping into that. I think that's quite exciting. And also something we've talked about a lot with this podcast is, you know, sometimes you want to feel like you're giving people something they can go away and do. And if you listen to this, you can go away, like Lola said, and talk to the HR people at your company and see, you know, what their policy is on it and see if they'd be interested in getting living wage accreditation.
If you're not inspired by Tyree, then, you know, you need to get out more. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Don't you think he was incredibly inspiring?
Amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, it's all started with a cup of coffee with an organizer. And now he's a sort of, you know, not just led the Fight for 15, was at the governor's mansion, but, you know, he wants to go further. I think the other thing that I take out of it, and I think your point about activism is right, and what our listeners can do is, you know, you need all of the tools. I mean, that's sort of what the Torsten bit of the interview shows. You know, you need the living wage, minimum wage, but you also need... There's no point in increasing the living wage and then cutting the tax credits. You need all of these things working in concert, but it definitely can be done.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast. Or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And here to pitch us some ideas which could be potential reasons to be cheerful, we're joined by comedian Pianovelli, or should I say comedian and podcaster now?
Yes, that's right. I finally joined the noble ranks.
Yeah, I think there are more podcasters than non-podcasters.
More podcasters than audience members.
quite likely, yeah.
I think in the future everyone will have a podcast for 15 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, what is your podcast?
It's called Bud Pod. And it's with myself and Reasons to be Cheerful alumnus, yes, Phil Wang. It's just a general humor podcast.
Friend of the pod, yeah, as the Americans would
friend
say.
Friend of the pod.
Well, let's see if Pierre can also become friend of the pod.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're on the pod, then you're a friend of the pod, aren't
you? I don't know. There's a few of them.
Really?
Do you not think? I won't be naming names.
Enemy of the pod.
So Pierre, you brought some ideas along with you.
Yeah.
What's your first one?
First one, illegal to provide journalism or journalistic services for free. Illegal, can't do it.
So this is a way of making sure that journalism is properly funded.
Yes, so this is my crude statist solution to the problem of advertising.
Interesting.
Because advertising was fine in print media, but now that everything's routed through Facebook and Google, they get all the advertising money like a big beaver dam, and none of it goes to the journalists. And so there's no journalism anymore, local journalism is dying. Blah, blah, blah. So if you just made a law where you say, we don't care if you charge a penny a month, you have to charge something for your news. You can't just have it out there and go that today's Pepsi headlines. You can't do that.
What about citizen journalism? So if I see something, as happened to me on one occasion, if I see somebody sitting on the tube cross-legged with their feet on the seats and they tweet about it, isn't that technically journalism? Am I not reporting something that has happened?
Storytelling does not come under journalism.
There's a line. Somewhere is a line.
Yes, yes. We'll establish a committee of inquiry or something. I know this is going to be a hard process, but I just think that once you set up a thing where people accept... Basically, it's like compulsory paywall. So basically, once people accept that they have to go and put up with a paywall, which is hopefully starting to happen more and more, then they will hope because they
hate
have to
paywalls.
We all hate them, but like
The worst one is when you get a certain number of free articles per month, and you accidentally use one of your clicks up on something rubbish.
Yes, then
you know it's on the New Statesman website, and you've hit a wall. You can't read this thing that you really want to read because you accidentally clicked a link off Twitter.
But you don't feel motivated enough to pay anything.
Well, that's it.
If there was just one button that did everything, then instead of having to fill in a form and fill in those little three numbers,
and forget
your
password,
all that stuff, then maybe.
Because it's like, so if you look at sort of Netflix versus Hulu versus Amazon Prime versus, you know, all these streaming services for entertainment, that's starting to help get money back into production and things that was getting lost through, especially with movies and things.
But, you know, I'd make an observation about this, which may be wrong and may be right, which is that I think that the revolt, in inverted commas, against the BBC license fee has gone back into decline because of things like Netflix. In other words, the sort of flat rate subscription thing was like, oh, this is the poll tax of, you know, TV. And now it's sort of what Netflix and lots of other people do. And says,
I've also got sort of like-minded friends who have been ardent BBC supporters their whole life, who've said things to me recently that's like, I've always been a big supporter of the BBC, but now that I get my news from these places and now I get my TV from these places, I find myself using it less and less, and I wonder if a subscription model is the way to go in the future, which I don't. I mean, I'm very happy to pay the license fee and to be paid by the license fee.
Indeed.
But
it's a the compulsory nature. Yeah. Of it, I see.
If you could, if you could find a way of making it more like a subscription, then what that would do is, and I mean, I don't know if I believe the BBC would ever use this weapon, but it'd be nice to know they had it in their arsenal. Then if someone said, I'm paying my license fee for a documentary about, and they whiny idiots right in, then the BBC could go, unsubscribe, you fucking asshole. We're not making you watch this.
What do you think of this idea then? No journalism for free.
A desperate attempt to.
I'm not sure. What do you think?
Well, I think I want to see properly funded journalism.
Yeah.
So there's something in it from that perspective. I also don't want Pierre to feel so rejected on his first idea.
Okay, fine.
We nearly always just go on with things.
Okay, we buy
it. I don't know what's wrong with you this week.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a flying car, it's fine. But okay.
Journalistic solution.
We love it. It's great.
All right, what you got next, Pierre?
Compulsory statistics education.
Oh, yes, I love this.
Yeah. So you're a big one on compulsory.
Yes, yeah. I've always been a
bureaucracy is quite
bureaucracy is
yeah
it's quite civitas
yeah
if you're a citizen it comes with the, you have to be equipped to be one,
right? So you've got to be compulsory statistics education,
but there's a caveat. It has to be pitched in a particular way.
So obviously
there's already maths at school, and statistics is a subgroup of maths, however there should be a class which is called whatever, compulsory statistics, but the way it should be pitched is, here is how people are going to try and trick you out of your money and life and home,
and they can show a picture of Boris Johnson and sort of say, you know, when someone tells you 350 million for the NHS, it's not necessarily true.
Yeah, or do a tube announcement. This man is a well-known scam artist. Yeah. Do not give him any votes.
Exactly.
He earns a lot more than you or I.
Did you feel you had statistics education?
Almost none.
But crucially, that the twist would have to be that they go, oh, and see, this is how you do a bar chart. And then the next lesson would be, here's how you do a bar chart if you're a liar. And you go, you make sure that the thing doesn't start at zero. You make sure it starts at a million. Yeah. So a million looks like zero.
Well,
and now you're all homeless.
Yes. And what's quite interesting, a lot of the polls, a lot of the statistics gatherers, they do have all the raw data available for people to look at. Mm-hmm. They're usually funded by somebody who wants to prove a certain point.
Yeah.
And that's what the headline is. But it'd be nice to be able to delve into those figures and work out what's really going on.
Totally. So if you could just equip people with weapons that they're actually really going to need. But the only way that, young people or teenagers are like, or what I was like, I wouldn't have been interested if someone had said, if you see there's a long article about medical surgical outcomes, I don't care. Whereas if you'd said, someone's going to try and trick you out of a mortgage or something at some point, you need to be ready for when they come for you, I would have gone, okay, fair enough.
That's good.
And you could dress it up and be like, look, produce a graph to prove that your partner for this project is a stinky bumhead.
Yes.
You know?
We buy it, don't we?
Yes. All right. What's next?
Mouth noises should be illegal.
Can you elaborate?
It's entirely a pure vanity dictator style thing. I have a real hatred of. I've read it called misophonia.
I have. Yes.
So like people who chew with their mouths open, chewing gum, kind of slappy, wet mouth noises.
You can hear saliva.
I feel this is heading towards a bacon sandwich conversation.
No.
What, is that my excessive sensitivity?
I admired your technique.
Right, thank you. I was in favour. There wasn't too much noise. The noise wasn't the issue.
No.
Go on, say a bit more about the noises.
I'm not the one who, you know, has turned it into this condition by calling it misophonia, but some people have it with polystyrene rubbing.
So what about when you listen to podcasts? Do you hear like the saliva sloshing around in people's mouths?
If it's like just general, the noise of a human talking is fine. But I did once turn off a podcast that I really wanted to listen to because the interviewee had decided that they would just talk. Noisily eat a bag of carrot sticks and talk through them for the first 20 minutes of the interview. And that filled me with an instant fury that I can only describe.
The trouble is that you're now making me feel quite worried about conversations I have on the phone where I'm eating carrots or... I mean, you actually did this last night when you sort of rang up.
I was eating my dinner, yeah.
And I actually didn't find it too troublesome.
Mm.
It's totally irrational. I'm not sure it is that
irrational, actually.
But are you distracted by noises generally? So if I rang you from the bath, would the splashing annoy you?
It would... No, not in the same way. Because it's not even like a thought process. It's like an instant like irritation. It's like if someone kept burping next to you on the train.
Mm.
It's similar to that. Where you go, there's no real reason that the burping is a problem any more than if they were taking a phone call, because it's just noise out of a mouth. But
I would advise you to never take a train journey with my wife.
Is she a burper?
Oh, like you've never heard. I mean, yeah, inhuman.
Your wife is a burper?
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, it sounds like some kind of prehistoric creature back through the ages.
But is it like constant?
It's often.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay,
Should we move on?
What have you got next, Pierre?
You've had lots of very green people on, but I think that owning a car should be like owning a gun.
Oh, how so? Ooh.
But I don't mean it in the sense as... because I mean it in the sense of specifically the way that it's possible to own a gun in the UK now, in the sense that, so if you want to have a shotgun in the UK, it's a lot, or even a small pistol for dealing with, say, rats or something like that. It's quite easy to do if you're a farmer, and you probably need it if you're a farmer.
Is it true?
Yeah, you can get a license for a small 2.2 pistol for pest control and things like that. And the same should apply to cars.
Well, farmers need rats. Them,
apparently. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah. You could also.
Is that an effective sort of killing technique?
Well, they're definitely dead.
I know, but it's like.
I don't know
it's
if
a moving target, isn't
that's
it?
That's what I thought so, yeah.
I don't know if. Yeah. Anyway. But if you hit them, they're dead, I guess. Right. They're certainly not recuperating.
Anyway, we're off the point. Sorry. But,
With cars and things, it's like when you're in Piccadilly Circus and you see a guy in just like a Volkswagen just drive through, and you think, what the fuck are you doing? What is your business appointment in Piccadilly Circus?
Yeah, that
you, a normal man, are here in your car. You're a serial killer. What is this? So you just go, okay, no, nothing like that. So any big urban area where you could easily take the bus or a tube, you can have buses, taxis.
I mean, I'm quite sympathetic to this.
Buses, taxis, ambulances.
I'm the guy
service
driving industry. Through Piccadilly Circus occasionally. But anyway,
but
do you own a car?
No, but I live in a block of flats, so it would be unfeasible for me to own a car. But if you're a farmer, you do need a car because you live in the middle of nowhere. Buses, if they're even there, are irregular. So there should there should be a zoning thing. Should be a zoning thing. So like, hey, no, you're allowed a car in the same way that you're allowed a shotgun. If you apply for it and you demonstrate a need, you're allowed a license for one. But also the reason I say like guns is because cars and guns are both killing machines.
Yes.
Where you just sort of go, who's allowed to be in charge of an explosion-powered metal death machine? Anyone, really.
Yeah.
From the age of bloody 17.
I'm far more scared of getting in a car with somebody than I am of getting on an aeroplane.
Yeah, and I'm biased because as a stand-up, I have to regularly... So the first time I'm meeting someone is me getting a lift with them to the middle of nowhere, 4 hours away to do a gig.
Oh, God, that's so terrifying. You're just
consistently in a car on a highway with a stranger.
All right, well, I think we're on board with everything to a greater or lesser degree.
We are. I feel like we could blend the Jeffocracy and the Pierreocracy, and it would be the sort of golden mean.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, okay.
You'd be quite... I think you're a little bit more hands-off than Pierre.
Yeah.
Because of the amount of effort involved.
Yeah.
Pierre wants to get all up in people's business.
Well, that's the trouble, is that I'm going to end up David Davising my own proposals by not being willing to bother to do anything to make them happen.
You're sort of, it's your hyperactivity and Jeff's hyperpassivity combined, I think.
Yeah.
Your podcast is Bud Pod that you do with Phil Wang. And I'm guessing you're gigging all the time if people want to come and see you.
Yes, I actually, the 2nd of the of April to the 6th of April, I'm doing last year's Edinburgh show at Soho Theatre in Soho.
And the name of the show?
The name of the show is See Novelli, Hear Novelli, Speak Novelli.
Very good.
Which is, well, what's annoying is that there's a whole bit at the end about Brexit and stuff, but not the... Yeah. I tried to make it a sociological thing as a as an integrated, naturalized Brit, why I sort of, my take on it. So hopefully it shouldn't have aged too badly, given that my run starts 3 days after the 29th of March.
Well, let's see if that date means anything by then.
Yeah. I'm going to bring a baseball bat anyway to the theatre in case rioting mobs have already sprung up.
We'll look out for it.
Please do.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Right, we should thank our guests.
Ooh, do we have to go?
We do. Do you not want to go back to the day job?
Well,
you can stay here, hold up in the
attic. I don't think this week is going to be very tempting, do you?
Well, do you not think you know anything will be better than last week?
I'm not convinced.
We've been telling ourselves that for months now, haven't we?
What if I did whatever you do during the week? I'm not quite sure what that is. But, and then you substituted for me. Do you think anyone would notice?
I would be happy to give it a
who
go.
Who could you pretend to be, though?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm just trying to think what MP you look like.
I look a bit like that guy who wielded the mace.
Lord Russell Mole, yes. Yeah. Maybe. But then if you switched with him, that doesn't help me. I think there's nothing for it.
All right.
I'm going to have to go back.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. It was worth a try, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. We should thank our guests.
Tyree Johnson, Lola McAvoy, and Torsti Kinsbell.
And thanks to the fantastic Pierre Novelli for providing light relief on a much-needed week. Emma Corsham produces our podcast with research by Joel Pearce. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the ident said Seed composed the music.
Emily Power
provided the artwork.
He's been dry.
He's been rad.
These have been
reasons to be cheerful.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.